This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is April 2nd, 2020, and this is episode 183. I'm Scott DeLundbohm. Ian was unfortunately unable to join us tonight. However, on today's show, we have Dr. Rob Tarswell joining us to discuss the science and mental health implications of the COVID-19 response. First, we have to thank those who continue to help make the show possible. 89 people contribute every month. We unfortunately lost a couple patrons this week. We're now at $270 American per month. And in particular, we want to thank everyone who is able to stick with us through these difficult times. We definitely understand if you need to put a pause on your support for a couple months, but please just give us a heads up. And as we announced in the previous week, for the duration of the crisis, we've opened our Patreon Slack to all listeners. Visit legandbootmedia.ca, where you can fill out a request to join form. As well, follow us on Twitter, at PoliticoastPod. Ian's been live-tweeting all of the provincial announcements, both the Dr. Bonnie Henry daily COVID-19 update press conference, as well as all of the other announcement press conferences that have been happening as the government responds to the ongoing crisis. So give us a follow at Politicoast Pod. And finally, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN, all lowercase, for access to a special rate. For your free 2-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Joining me to discuss the COVID-19 situation from a medical perspective is Dr. Rob Tarswell. Good evening. Welcome to Politicoast.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on. So before you jump into this, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I finished my medical degree at the University of Manitoba in 2001, then went off to Halifax, Nova Scotia, did a psychiatry residency, which I finished in 2006, then practiced full-time and for a few years, and then switched to part-time practice while completing a second residency in nuclear medicine that I finished in 2012. And I've been practicing nuclear medicine and psychiatry since 2012. Plus, I'm a clinical assistant professor on the Faculty of Medicine at UBC, which means that I teach medical students and residents about various aspects of medicine. And sometimes that can be general medicine or more specifically psychiatry or nuclear medicine. And I also have a modest publication record in psychotherapy outcomes research and in functional brain imaging in psychiatric disorders. And I'm a voracious consumer of COVID-19 news, but who isn't?
Yeah, it seems to be the only thing we can talk about for the last month or so.
Yeah, I've noticed even like climate change stories. I'm like, ugh. And I'm usually all over that stuff. But now I just, no, too boring, too long term.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I know everything, like all the normal discussions I like to be having have just gone away completely. And
yes, agree.
My Twitter feed has gone from like all sorts of politics stuff, local housing stuff to pretty much only COVID.
Virus.
Yes.
It is the story of our time. And we'll
it's affected the discourse.
Yes.
Sorry,
go ahead. Sorry. Oh, I was just gonna just the jokes, the bad jokes write themselves.
Mm-hmm. But speaking of the discourse, you also are part of the Viral Transmissions weekly stream. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so that's a new podcast started by two of the three original Beatles of caustic soda podcast fame, Joe Foljam and Torrin Atkinson, and they reached out to me.
Joe, who's the former guest on this podcast from our Star Wars holiday special.
Oh, great.
So longtime listeners may remember that.
Excellent. Yeah. So those guys had a podcast from about 2010 to 2016. I was a semi-regular guest on the show. And they were both, as I was, concerned about the degree of misinformation and disinformation floating around. And we thought, hey, why don't we just put together a purpose-built vlogcast to specifically push out expert-level information, palatable for a general audience, and keep everybody informed, stay on top of current developments in the whole on the whole COVID-19 front, and just try and combat misinformation and disinformation. We've done two episodes now, and we're gearing up for our third one coming up on Sunday, where we're going to have a political scientist on to talk about the politics of pandemics.
Oh, excellent. Enjoyed the first two so far, so looking forward to the next one.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, so Sunday night, 8 o'clock Pacific. Tune in, everyone.
Yeah, and we'll have a link to that in our show notes.
Hope that doesn't conflict with your time.
We typically put this out Friday morning, so Most people will have listened to it by then.
All right, so by the end of the weekend, they're just itching for new, more. I need more virus information, more.
Exactly.
We've got it.
But speaking of virus information, let's jump into COVID-19 and all the questions that are surrounding it.
Yeah.
So I guess first off, it's been kind of the big response and kind of the headline item has been what was until last week called social distancing, and now is there seems to be a vocab update to physical distancing.
Right.
So what's happening with that?
Well, that's still being recommended, and every day I watch the Minister of Health here in BC's update. So Minister Adrian Dix, together with Dr. Bonnie Henry, the public health officer for British Columbia, and they're banging that drum. We need 100% commitment from everybody to social distancing, which basically means stay home unless you need to go out. And that basically means like shopping for supplies or medical appointments or exercise. And when you're out, that's 2 meters or about one hockey stick away from everybody. Frequent hand hygiene when out or when just coming back home and through your front door. And that's basically it. So you're either home, you're separate when you're out, and lots of hand hygiene. So the goal is, because this is a virus that's spread in respiratory droplets, and those are the droplets, those are the things that we're always emitting from when we're breathing. Those ones go the shortest distance, then talking, shouting, singing, coughing, and sneezing. Sneezing's the worst. There's some research suggesting sneezed droplets can go up to 60 meters, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
I was pretty stunned when I read that. I hope that those are like exceptional super sneezer drops, but
the furthest they've ever measured it in like the rare, you know.
Yeah, I think more likely it's going to be about 6 meters. And then
just still a lot.
It's still a lot. Yeah. So, and then the things we don't think about are the things like talking loudly. There's some research from 2019 suggesting that talking loudly produces about 6 times the number of droplets as talking softly. So if you're out there on the seawall thinking you're doing your thing and you're on the cell phone and you're one of those people that can't self-regulate how loudly you speak when you're on the phone and you just get louder and louder and louder, you could be a little droplet factory while you're on that call. So,
right. And certainly for the people who do still work, part of the essential industries list that got put out earlier this week. So, avoid the work meeting if you can help it.
Exactly. Yeah. So there was that case, I think it was Washington State. I'm not entirely sure exactly where it happened, but 45 people had a choir meeting. And 8 of them ended up infected, or I believe 10 got infected and 2 died. So yeah, singing in a closed room for 2.5 hours, that was enough to create what we would call like a super spreading event, which is where someone spreads the virus to more than we would expect them to. In this case, the average spreader or the average infected person infects between 2 and 3 people.
Right. And that's what's known as the R-naught, or basic reproduction number, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. The number goes up if people are close together and crowded. So the highest that we're aware of was patient 31 in Korea, who actually infected 1,200 people.
And that was direct infections, not chains.
That's right. That's right. So, and that was a function of a particular religious practice that this individual belonged to, where individuals are crowded together almost shoulder to shoulder in kind of call and response sort of activities that can go for hours. And then also went to a buffet lunch after the service with presumably other members of the church, because you know, anyone who grew up in church knows, you know, after church, buffet lunch is what you do. That's what we did out in Chilliwack when I was a good church going guy back in my young days. But what is interesting in her case is that she was actually had been ordered into self-isolation by public health officials in South Korea because she presented for medical attention with a fever and had actually qualified and received a test for the virus and was said, until we get this result, you go home. And she said, I'm going to church. And off she went. And this led to a massive early outbreak in Korea, which they got right on top of with a massive testing campaign where they essentially tested nearly everybody in this 200,000 member religious community. An absolutely heroic effort. And since
then, yeah, that's
amazing.
It's a huge it's a huge amount. And so I'm just looking at the stats now, and Korea has about 9,900 cases. So this is 1/10 of their entire epidemic was caused by one individual breaking the public health rules.
It's quite impressive, isn't it? Yeah. So there are ways to be irresponsible on a catastrophic level, especially if you are a loud talker. Your R naught might be a lot higher than 3. So
yeah, you don't even necessarily know that you're going to be that one individual too, which I suppose we should then discuss, what do we know about how this spreads? You mentioned droplets and people sneezing, coughing.
Right. Yep.
But there's been a lot of talk, especially recently, about asymptomatic spread, whether or not it can be contact, all of these sorts of things. So how does the virus spread?
So as far as we understand it, it does just come down to respiratory droplets. And those are primarily, if you're unlucky, you're near somebody and those droplets end up directly in your airway, which is why the number one method of community spread is close individuals. So household members, family members. A friend of mine, Dr. Greg Rose in Ottawa, who is an infectious disease specialist, the last time I checked with him, the current consensus for likelihood of transmission is close contact for about 30 minutes. That seems to be sufficient to trigger an infection. So those are going to be nurses in close care settings, physicians in close care settings, members of households with individuals who are sick. And those droplets can either end up directly in your airway, or of course, they can contaminate your face, they can contaminate your skin, on your hands especially. And it could be a pretty straightforward matter of you cared for somebody, forgot to wash your hands, eat a sandwich, boom, you've managed. If some of those viral, you know, the stuff you swallow, that's not a problem. That's going to get taken care of by your digestive system. But if any of that, you know, but of course, the way we're evolutionarily designed, our oropharynxes, there's all sorts of mixture of secretions. Not all of that gets swallowed down. Some of that could end up on the back of your throat, and eventually it finds its way into the trachea and we're off to the races. So those respiratory droplets can also persist for some periods on other surfaces. So this is the so-called elevator button transmission or the doorknob transmission. That can lead to infections, although it's quite a bit less likely because the droplet then has to go through kind of a multi-step process before it ends up in you. But nonetheless, out of an abundance of caution, public health is recommending just, you know, washing your hands. Although the primary vehicle is droplets on your hand, making it directly to your mouth. So sort of a like a one step or like the zero step would be the droplet ends up in your airway. So somebody coughs or sneezes or breathes and that hits your eye, the mucous membranes of your eye, or somehow in your nose or in the back of your throat.
Right. And the another part of the public health advice is to clean frequently touched surfaces at least once per day as well. So like doorknobs, right. Elevator right. buttons, all of that. And I know some of the local municipalities have disabled those bag buttons to activate the crosswalk signs.
That's right. Yeah, I think all of Calgary has switched their pedestrian-controlled intersections to timed intersections. That I don't think that's happened here in Vancouver. It certainly hasn't happened on any of the intersections near my place.
I believe I saw something about might be Burnaby or the Tri-Cities somewhere in that area had made some changes.
Good. I mean,
it's not universal.
Yeah. So use your elbow to bump the cross buttons. But I imagine I don't have to tell anyone. We figured that all out, right? We've all figured out now. Use your elbow for buttons, back through doors, things like that.
Exactly.
Touch them if you have to, but avoid it if you can.
Yeah. Now, the other thing I'm a little curious about is the transmission, what happens in like multi-stages. So say I haven't washed my hands in a while. I touch something. I go wash my hands, 20 minutes later, absentmindedly, I pick it up again. Am I at risk then?
Yeah. So there could be some degree of low risk. There was a study that came out now, I want to say around March the 16th or so, talking about the viability of the virus on various surfaces, specifically plastic, steel, copper, cardboard. I think this study just made the rounds like wildfire. And researchers showed, wow, this thing's viable on all sorts of surfaces for quite a while. The question then, though, is that a sufficient amount to cause an infection? Because if you really say you get hit by say 0.1 micron droplet hits your eye, is that enough of a viral load to trigger an infection? At the moment, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure if the answer is known. Those are questions that are hard to figure out in human beings. We can study them in animal models, but there's not really a good animal model that really tells us much about human infection at this stage.
Right, you can't get the ethics approval to just randomly try and infect people to find out.
No, you cannot randomize people to a harmful outcome, unfortunately. Well, fortunately. But the good news is, I mean, we have innate immunity. So we have the parts of our immunity that just respond to all foreign agents, plus the parts of our immunity that learn a specific response and are able to kill the virus on re-exposure. So innate immunity is what attempts to kill the virus on an initial exposure, and that can take care of tiny amounts, but it's those larger amounts. Eventually, something is going to get through the guardians at the gate and make it into the citadel, which is your lungs. So those issues of contact, in theory, they could lead to transmission. So we want to be careful with, wiping surfaces, washing your hands and things like that. But I don't think we need to freak out if you've forgotten to wash your hands and you pick up your iPhone and then you wash your hands and you pick up your iPhone again and then you eat a sandwich, right? I don't think you need to induce vomiting and call 811 at that point, right? You can probably relax because the thing they showed that there's viability of this virus, but it's not clear if that would be at a level that's sufficient to cause a clinical infection. It's a big
question. They may have just detected it long after enough of it had died that it wouldn't be a infectious amount.
Yeah. I mean, but of course, again, it costs us nothing to be prudent around situations like that.
Yeah. I mean, my soap budget's gone up a bit, but small price to pay.
Yeah. It's funny how the hand sanitizer just got devastated on the retail shelves. But there's lots of soap out there. And, you know, this virus is uniquely susceptible to soap because it has a lipid.
It's a ball of fat, basically, right?
Well, it's got a lipid bilayer, that thing that we all learned about in high school biology class, if we were paying attention. And lipid bilayers are uniquely sensitive to soap, and soap basically can completely absorb that the membrane around the virus, and the virus literally falls apart and stops being a self-reproducing illness machine at that point. So I'm seeing all sorts of ads on Facebook for UV lights and this and that, and as many of them as I can, I'm trying to either comment or share them and say, you know, what's even more effective? A soapy cloth, because soap kills the virus. And we know soap kills the virus because of this.
Right. So if you want to disinfect your phone, for example,
yep.
That's, you probably don't need to go out and try and scour for the, you know, three boxes of Lysol wipes that still exist in the city.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can just take a wet cloth with soap and
soapy rag. Yeah. It's less sexy, but it's more effective and it's cheaper. But of course everybody's phones are made of glass these days. So you're probably going to, like, that thing's going to go shooting out of your hand and hit the bathroom floor. But that's another issue, right? I leave it as an exercise to the listener to figure out, safe ways to wash their phone without leading to, fractured screens.
Okay. And the one final question I have before we, move off of the spread of this virus is, there's been a lot of talk about asymptomatic spread and whether or not people in that kind of 5 to 14 day period after they've been infected and before they show symptoms, can they spread the virus?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the latest on that?
Asymptomatic spread, is a pretty common feature in most respiratory viral illnesses because the virus is, it's in you, it's multiplying. And for respiratory viruses, it's coming out in droplets. There's less of it. So the respiratory droplets have less of a load. So you're less infectious, but that doesn't mean you're not infectious. And that kind of spread is certainly the case. And there's some data I saw recently suggesting that at any given time, perhaps 20% of individuals are either asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic carriers of the virus. And that's going to be responsible for some degree of community transmission.
Okay. So even if you aren't showing symptoms,
just
take the precautions. And one of the best pieces of advice I've seen, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, is just the advice to act as if you are infectious yourself and are trying to prevent others from catching it.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is a good kind of mental reset. It's sort of like, it's one thing to go out and think, I've got to avoid everyone. I've got to avoid everyone because they could be sick. They could be sick. Well, that, that can lead to a lot of anxiety. Just a simple way of reframing it is think, hey, you know, imagine if I was sick and I didn't want to give this to anybody, how would I behave? You'd probably end up behaving in broadly similar ways, but you really only have to think about your own distance from other individuals at that point. And if somebody gets close, then you go, oh, I better back off. I might be sick. Instead of it becoming this internal battle where it's like, hey, man, get out of my space.
Right.
So, you know, we're all at home. We're all kind of bored. We're all kind of anxious. Tempers are running hot. Find ways to hack your own cognitive processes to just make yourself that little bit kinder.
Well, that's good advice. Let's move on to what's happening with testing.
Sure.
So it's kind of been one of the big things that's been talked about, especially if the US was slow to roll out theirs. We've been doing a much better job.
Yes.
But nevertheless, there's still been a lot of commentary I've seen about, are we testing enough? Are we testing the right people?
Yeah.
Like just for a personal example, a couple of weeks ago, I had this horrible cough. Might be the virus, might not. Self-isolated, filled out their little survey on the website and was told, don't get tested, just stay at home. So why is that happening when, you know, it might be useful to know whether or not I had the virus?
Right. So the goal of a medical test or the goal of testing isn't to identify every possible case. The reason we, generally speaking, test somebody in medicine is if the result of that test will change the intervention. So in the case of an individual in the community who develops respiratory illness symptoms, the intervention is isolation. So if you, as a member of the community, are able to isolate, then you should isolate. And knowing whether or not your test is positive isn't going to change the intervention. In a hospital, if a physician tests positive, or a nurse tests positive, or a respiratory therapist, or anybody really tests positive, that's going to change a lot of things. That person's going to be pulled out of frontline care. They're going to be sent home to isolate. Someone's going to have to come in and replace them. We're also going to have to go and find out all the people that they were involved with, whether those individuals may have caught the virus. So did this trigger an outbreak? So all sorts of things change as a result of that positive test in the case of that healthcare worker who tests positive. Whereas those of us, say, in the community, this doesn't necessarily change anything. So we want to know, of course, well, is there any activity in the community? And in BC, we actually have something called the Influenza Surveillance Network, which means that there are physicians around the province who do test individuals with influenza-like illness. And the whole time, those swabs have been getting sent in. And we do have a random sample of the community from basically cities and towns all over BC through that network, whereby we can keep an eye on everything that's going on by taking those swabs, and once they're done being tested for influenza, running them through secondary testing for COVID-19. And so far, that's been ongoing, right?
So we can kind of pick up a bit of what the background rate is from that.
Exactly. You don't have to eat the whole pot of soup to know how the soup tastes. That this is kind of the fundamental kind of issue in statistics, is trying to figure out what's happening in the whole population from samples of the population. And the way to get at that is through this kind of background monitoring and surveillance that's been going on. We don't need to test everybody. We need to detect where outbreaks are happening. And so in places where there is a higher likelihood of outbreaks, there's a lower threshold to initiate testing, because again, that's going to change what we do. So specifically in BC, there's been the outbreak that's hit a number of long-term care homes. And that was a function of the fact that a lot of people who work in long-term care homes are often assigned to multiple homes. And there has been, up until now, a network of workers who could find themselves working here on day one, here on day two, here on day three. And it turns out that that has led to what so far has been identified cases in 21 care homes. The largest.
Right, all of them in the Lower Mainland, I believe. So a lot of cross-contamination may be happening.
That's right. So within fairly early on, but finally this came to fruition, is on a temporary basis, a lot of these workers who were privately employed have essentially all been hired by the province, boom, and are now guaranteed a salary and are only able to work in one facility. So to break the chains of transmission and stop the spread through care homes, because of course individuals in care homes tend to be older, tend to have a lot of other medical illnesses, and are so in a uniquely vulnerable position if they catch the virus. And then just today we found out that in the Okanagan, an inmate who was, I believe, recently incarcerated at a correctional facility, has tested positive. That individual's been isolated. The members of that individual's pod have also been isolated, and public health is right on top of it. Whereas for those of us in the community, stay home. That's the cure, as it were, or at least it's not the cure for the virus, but it's the cure to break the chain of transmission.
Right. So, so that's kind of why we're testing. What can the test results that we've got so far and kind of the numbers that get reported every day tell us about what's happening and kind of what are the limitations of it?
Sure. Well, of course, you know, public health agencies are well aware that there are more cases in the community than positive test numbers, and they are able to kind of estimate or model that. But still, the positive tests give pretty good indications in terms of which way the pandemic is going. Are cases increasing, holding steady, or decreasing? And in BC, at least over the past 4 or 5 days, the number of daily cases has been holding steady in the 50 to 60 range. So as of today, we got into about the 1100 range in terms of total cases, about 50 testing positive. I've got the precise numbers written down somewhere, but they're pretty close. And so over the past week, we have had about a 5 to 6% rate of daily growth. And if you remember way back to high school, if you learned compound interest, the rule of 72, you take the daily growth rate, divide it into 72, and that tells you that BC is now on a 12-day doubling for total number of cases. Whereas previously, we'd been at about a 24% growth rate or on the 3-day doubling line. So we've fallen well off that line so far. And the hope is that this is the critical week where we can really break that first pandemic wave.
Right. This is the flattening the curve that everyone's been talking about.
This is the flattening the curve, right. So that we don't overwhelm the hospitals. And what the Ministry of Health, it's been on like a serious, serious war footing for this. So flatten the curve to try and get the best outcome possible, but be ready for a Northern Italy type scenario. And they've even, right. That's the language they've even used in their briefings. So we have about 70 people in ICU, about 140 people in hospital total, and yet we have 4,200 beds and another 2,000 subacute beds being made, and we have capacity for maybe another 2 to 290 people in ICUs. And so everybody's like, well, geez, what's all that extra capacity for? Well, that extra capacity is if something goes terribly wrong and this thing breaks out, because we're not in a containment stage at this point. We're in a mitigation stage, which means trying to just there's the recognition that little fires have broken out everywhere, and the goal is to prevent any of them from becoming big fires. And that's why we need broad social cooperation. We're the trees, so we all have to stay apart from each other so the fire stops leaping from tree to tree. Whereas in the containment stage, which was the path we were on in February, there was a different strategy in terms of testing, which was to find every possible case so we can quarantine them all definitively and snuff this thing out. That ended up not working out, largely related to, you know, inbound travelers who were either some level of confusion around communication of information at airports, or individuals simply not taking the issue seriously early on and so forth. There's been a lot of clarity, I think, over the last few days. The federal government has brought down the Quarantine Act, which imposes a lot of legal duties and potential penalties on individuals who are ordered into quarantine. That should take care of some issues at YVR. There's going to be increased staffing. Individuals are going to be informed what's going on, ordered into quarantine. And then at our regional airports, those remain sort of within the provincial responsibility. But there's going to be a bigger effort, especially now that the federal government is making huge efforts to start repatriating individuals currently sort of stuck overseas for various reasons. So there's a cruise ship that's going to be docking in Florida in the next couple of days. There's some British Columbians on there who are going to be repatriated. They're going to land, they're going to be read the Riot Act. But ultimately, you know, unless we literally lock people in jail or in facilities, they're going to have at least the capability of disobeying the law. And so what Dr. Henry has emphasized is that not only do individuals have to meet that obligation to stay in quarantine, but we as society have an obligation to them to make that feasible. So can neighbors bring groceries? Can these burdens be spread around? So one hopes that these kinds of creative solutions will emerge locally, but that's not really something that can be directed top down that can really only be appealed for.
Right. And it's really important to keep that tight and prevent spread, because like we saw in New York and Italy that it doesn't take very long to have cases just explode. Like New York's at 93,000 right now, and they were a tenth of that just like a week or two ago.
Yeah.
And it can really blow up. And I think it's 20% roughly of patients need hospitalization. So even all those beds that the province has set aside, that only gets us maybe 20,000 cases before we hit the wall of what the healthcare system can do.
That's right. And in fact, based on our current caseload of around 1,100, I think 16% are in hospital right now. So we are not bucking that trend. So our number of cases is requiring the level of hospitalization. We have slightly higher ICU numbers because our critical care approach has been early ventilation rather than late ventilation in the hope of intervening to prevent a really serious case of ARDS and then intubating, which...
For the people who aren't familiar with the acronyms, what's ARDS?
So that's the acute respiratory distress syndrome. This virus causes pneumonia in both lungs simultaneously, and that pneumonia can spread without much trouble at all throughout the entire lung. And our ICUs are getting individuals onto ventilators to try and prevent that from spreading, essentially using positive pressure ventilation, meaning squeezing a little, you know, when we breathe, it's always kind of at one atmosphere. We can add a little extra shot of pressure in a ventilator to try and essentially squeeze water out of the lungs and keep it in the body instead of in the air spaces. And the hope is that this can prevent the development of really severe ARDS. We don't know if that's true because, you know, we've only had this virus with us since late December. And really, we only really got our first case in BC, was identified on January the 28th after we began testing on January the 27th. So there's a lot more that we don't know about this thing than that we know. But that's been the approach here in BC. And so far, we've been favored with relatively low mortality.
Yeah, so it's still early days. And like you said, we're in the trying to lock everything down phase. So
right. It's
no reason to celebrate or let off the gas at all in terms of trying to lock this down. But I have been at least a little more optimistic in the past weeks just because that rate of case growth has been slow and the government's really taken that kind of wartime footing with regards to prepping the healthcare system.
And the dropping of the new cases, at least as a numerator, has shown us the proof of principle of social distancing. We now have proof that in principle, this really does work. So until we get a vaccine, this is going to be a really critical tool because at some point, this pandemic wave will ebb. Right now, it's heading to a crest. We'll get through the crest, and it's going to ebb. We don't know what that's going to look like, ultimately, in BC. But at some point, someone's going to say, all right, well, how do we turn society back on? How do we turn the economy back on, knowing that this thing is still out there, just floating around, waiting for a chance to just start spreading again? And so it's going to be this process of getting through a mitigation phase and then going back onto a containment footing and trying to contain infections while we work around them, which has been sort of the Singapore and Taiwan approach. All right, we've captured it. It's back in containment with aggressive testing, contact tracing, and quarantine. We can allow individuals to kind of re-engage in the economy around these little quarantines that are happening all over the place. Those plans, no doubt, are being formulated by public health, and we'll see what those look like once this first wave is crested.
Do we have any idea of when that's going to be?
You know, I don't even think Dr. Henry knows when that's going to be, so I would just be looking in a crystal ball at that point.
Okay. Oh, yes, an ever-changing situation. Before we move on to off of testing. Just one other question I have, which is kind of related to this and the discussions around immunity, is there's been talk of antibody tests, right, and whether or not that's going to reveal people who've had the virus and are now immune or maybe immune. Do we know what the immunity situation is, and whether or not we can find out who in the population may be immune because they've had it?
Yeah, so we absolutely want antibody tests. So those are tests that look back. So the current tests we're doing, they actually look for evidence of the viral genetic material in your secretions. The antibody test looks for antibodies in your blood, which mean that you have developed that kind of mature immune response to the virus, or humoral immunity, we could call it. Or it's basically, you now have cells that can secrete specific antibodies that recognize the components of this virus and can attack it on sight, and you have immunity. And we are very much interested in that kind of a test, because then we can start, especially if it's a rapid test that can be administered at scale. The thing about the PCR test, or the test used to detect the virus, is that's the slow one that takes time to run. It takes a specific amount of expertise, lots of chemical reagents. Luckily, we have lots of capacity in BC. Our capacity is quite a bit higher than the amount that we're testing. Whereas an antibody test is potentially one that would be great. Once we can get it, it would be quite a bit more rapid. And that one could be the one that tells us, okay, you know, what percentage of individuals were asymptomatic carriers? What percentage of those folks who were all at home being good citizens with colds and flus and influenza-like symptoms, how many of them had this virus? And one thing that's interesting in Germany, I think I read the other day, they are issuing certificates of immunity to individuals who can show these to the police say, no, it's cool, I'm immune. I'm not a threat to public health by being out here. And it would be really great. Just imagine knowing you're immune, and you can go back.
It would be really nice to know if the thing I had a couple weeks back was it, and I could now, you know, not have to worry quite as much.
What a difference in your life. Or you become the guy that can help your elderly neighbors or help out your family. This confers significant freedom of action, because we know that there is going to be some sort of long-term immunity. We don't know how long that's going to last. Will it be months, a year, longer? That remains to be seen, because again, you know, there's just so little we know about this thing. But I think public health in BC is very excited about the possibility of getting antibody tests. They don't want to rush into it, because I believe there have been some situations where jurisdictions have ordered large numbers of antibody tests, and they've just been found to either be defective or unsuitable for other reasons. And of course, one can never completely overlook the possibility of profiteering and opportunism as well.
Right. That's something we want to get right, not quick.
Yes. Yes. So there's no specific urgency to that antibody test. That's one you definitely want to get right. There's definitely urgency to who's infected now. So that's one that rolled out pretty quickly. Although luckily, based on well-established technology in infection control and in genetics, and really, so that one was discovered quickly. It's just a technically demanding test, and therefore has some inaccuracy because of that. But this next one, you know, we really want to get it right. If we're telling you you're immune, we want to get that right before we send you loose out into the world. So we want, you know, we would like a nice, highly accurate test on that front.
Of course. I suppose I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about the thing that seems to be on everybody's mind right now, which is, should I wear a mask? This is being the thing that's ballooned up in the past couple of days as the big debate.
So this started, I think, with that Saturday editorial in the Washington Post by Dr. Howard, who's an emergency physician in New York, saying, you know, look, masks probably aren't harmful. There's evidence that they might be helpful. It's biologically plausible, because if we again, if we assume that we have the virus and we breathe and the mask is catching our respiratory droplets, then we're going to spread the virus less, right? So there's a case that certainly can be made for masks. And there's some research literature that shows, yes, individuals with masks, right? If they cough or sneeze in the mask catches the droplets and so forth. It's not an entirely clear picture though, right? There was a meta-analysis in 2017, which looked at the question, are masks actually effective at slowing down influenza transmission in real world conditions? And they looked at the H1N1, which was the swine flu virus in 2009, which led to a pandemic. And they were interested, okay, what interventions that an individual can do are helpful? And so they were interested in three things: hand washing, mask wearing, and cough etiquette, meaning coughing into your elbow, not onto your hands. And they found that the evidence for hand washing was a slam dunk. It easily reached statistical significance. The evidence for masks didn't reach statistical significance. They ended up in their conclusion. It's interesting. Their conclusion, they kind of got out over their skis compared to the actual findings in the study, where they very clearly said that the use of masks does not rise to statistical significance. They went ahead and recommended masks and hand washing anyway. Because, you know, maybe it helps, but their study itself, which ultimately looked at 16 trials from an initial search through about 2,000 trials, couldn't find evidence that separates the effectiveness of masks from chance. However, because the idea of masks is so intuitive, it's kind of taken off like wildfire. And everyone's like, well, duh, if you breathe and talk, the mask catches your droplets. Sure, and I fully grant that this is an intuitive, biologically plausible argument. Let's go even further. Let's say that masks are effective and that they're more effective than the evidence suggests, that they are effective in real-world conditions. What's even more effective is staying home. What's also effective is maintaining distancing. This is the whole point of the distancing. That is also an effective droplet mitigation strategy. That's why it got recommended by health in the first place. It's amazing how many people on Twitter have been going out of their way to tell public health that there are these respiratory droplets and we need to do something about them. Thank you.
it's like how I, every time there's a, article about mass timber building, somebody always responds to with, you know, wood burns, right? As if engineers and architects are just being made aware of this. It's pretty much the same thing, but for doctors.
Yeah. So let's go all the way and let's say that the evidence is a slam dunk. You know, my read of the evidence is it's not a slam dunk. The World Health Organization's read is it's not a slam dunk. The Centers for Disease Control, it's not a slam dunk. BC CDC, it's not a slam dunk. Dr. Henry was asked point blank about masks yesterday and said, well, you know, they probably don't hurt. If you want to wear one, go ahead. Just be careful about being clean. But the main interventions are staying home, staying apart, and washing your hands. So my fundamental problem, which nobody has been able to address, is let's say masks work. Let's say they work like a hot damn. What happens now? Every single piece that says, yeah, masks, quickly says, oh, but don't take any for doctors and hospitals. Don't take any of the nurses' masks. Make your own. Well, who's going to actually do that? Who knows how to do that? What are you going to do if you're scared and you suddenly get swayed by this nascent mask fascism? You're going to do what everyone else does. You're going to go on Amazon. You're going to find somebody selling masks and you're going to click buy and add it to your shopping cart. Well, guess what? You've just added stress to the already incredibly stressed supply lines and supply chains going to hospitals. It's not an accident that there's basically like a 24/7 working group in every public health region scrambling to try and find PPE. The mask advocates all say, well, you know, We should all wear masks, but we shouldn't stress that supply. Well, what do you think's going to happen, realistically, looking at human nature, if the drumbeat from everywhere is you've got to wear a mask, you've got to wear it now, and we have all sorts of people who, guess what, don't know how to use sewing machines?
It'll probably be like the toilet paper. There'll be a big run on it.
It's going to be like the toilet paper, exactly. So what we're going to end up doing is stressing supply chains for this product, which makes sense in healthcare settings. Think of droplets like rain. In the hospital, it's always raining. So it makes sense for healthcare workers to have umbrellas. When we go out and we carry an umbrella, it's really easy for us to avoid the rain clouds. We just stay 6 feet apart from each other. And you can walk around the rain clouds outside. And
this might not be the best analogy for a Vancouver-based audience, but...
Okay, maybe not. But these are special rain clouds that only... They throw little droplets out, and you pass by them in a couple of seconds. Who needs masks? Well, individuals who are on chemotherapy, individuals who are immune compromised, individuals who need that nth degree of protection. I don't think... anybody is saying that there's no protection at all from masks. The question is the benefit worth the social risks and costs? And at this stage, it's not clear to me that it is. But this hasn't stopped this drumbeat, which has now gone to, I think, a really irrational level, where in fact, from the beginning, because, hey, guess what? We've known that droplets are a thing all along. Stay in your house. Stay apart, wash your hands. That is the droplet mitigation. It's just really unfortunate that all these triggers are getting pulled when there's already enormous stress. And then everyone's saying, oh, well, of course, what we need to do is nationalize mass production. Oh, well, of course, what we need to do is subsidize mass production. Well, who's doing that? Where are these subsidies coming from? I haven't seen any evidence anywhere of that leading to any kind of massive market response in terms of masks, right? If the Prime Minister of Canada is giving relief in his voice at press briefings that a plane has finally landed with a million masks on it, this tells you where we're at least right now. We're in a situation where there aren't easy market solutions to be had. Maybe those could happen. Yeah. I would absolutely advocate for nationalization of PPE production and nationalization of stockpiles. And you can bet I'm going to be paying very close attention to everybody's election platforms on pandemic preparedness in our next elections. And I would encourage everyone to be paying very close attention, because now we see what a black swan event looks like. And it's real, real bad. And it's worth chucking a few billion a year at to be ready to go at a moment's notice.
I believe I have seen a couple companies announced they're making cloth masks,
sure,
which is good, but like it's not the same as the N95 respirators, which I suppose we should probably differentiate, because those are a much higher grade. They have a special filter medium that I think requires blown fiber polypropylene filter, which I think the machines to make that cost $5 to $10 million.
Yeah,
so it's not
yeah.
something that you can just whip up,
right?
And there's an extremely limited supply. Those are needed for the people who are most at risk in the hospitals.
That's right.
And not only that, they're just hard to use. Like most people don't have the skill set to properly wear a respirator, and it's not something you can just look at YouTube for 5 minutes and try and figure it out.
Oh, I was on the bus about a week and a half ago, and I saw a guy wearing an N95 mask over his beard. And I was just like, oh my God, what are you doing? I didn't, that was inside voice, but still, I'm like, so this is great. And this is the thing that, public health is cognizant of, that I'm not entirely sure that the mask mafia is cognizant of, that, there's technique to wearing a mask. You have got to put that thing on properly. You can't touch it once it's on there. You've got to keep it clean. You've got to keep it dry. You've got to recognize that your mask really only has a limited life. Once that thing is damp, it's not useful anymore. You've got to keep it washed constantly. You've got to be meticulous about your hand hygiene when you're touching a mask, because if you are the infected one And you go to Safeway and you just pick up the bell peppers to see if they're firm enough. Boom, you've cross-contaminated, right? Or if you're near somebody who is throwing a coughing fit and you get nervous and you adjust your mask, there's a risk you've just self-contaminated because that person's cough droplets were on your hands and now they're under your mask. And dang it, that mask did nothing. So it's not a trivial intervention. But, you know, again, even if we grant that masks are a slam dunk intervention, it's not clear where these masks are coming from. And it's not clear to me at all that all the put a bow on it admonishments to, don't buy supplies off the internet, don't keep them away from hospitals, is going to make a lick of difference, right? How much a difference did it make all the cries of please don't buy all the toilet paper? It made zero difference, right? You've created...
And that's something that in theory is significantly less life-threatening or life-saving.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Anyone who has running water in their home has a solution to that problem. But all that happens is if you trigger a prisoner's dilemma with respect to these masks and a rush on an already strained supply, you know, congratulations. This is now the self-fulfilling prophecy. And then we end up with an increased risk of hospital outbreaks. And now we're looking at forcing nurses to do things like put their masks in microwaves and just come up with these really wartime type solutions to try and mitigate the risk wherever we can. If mass production was not an issue, if there was an abundant supply and somebody came along and said, hey, well, you know, there does seem to be some evidence that these things reduce risk of transmission. Hey, I'd slap a mask on too. But we have mitigation. The mitigation, I'll say it again, stay home. Stay 2 meters apart when you're out. Don't go out unless it's necessary. Frequent hand hygiene. You know, we have mitigation for respiratory droplets.
Okay. Well, before we let you go, I want to talk a little bit about the mental health aspects of the rather extreme change in living situation that and life that most people are going through right now.
Sure.
I mean, frankly, pretty tough to be stuck in a home for 2 weeks or longer, not being really able to go outside, see friends. Kind of, what's the expected effects on people? And kind of what can we do to help ourselves in these situations?
Right. So, I mean, early on, I think the initial response was a kind of a shock and a lot of anxiety. And a lot of people were just pretty freaked out by what's going on. And some people were struggling with sort of dissociative symptoms. Like I lost track of the number of times I read people talking about feeling like they're in a dream or they don't know who they are or where they are or what time it is. And suddenly
it still seems a little surreal even after a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Now what's going to happen is I think the shock or the, you know, you could call it the corona adrenaline has kind of worn off. I think there's some baseline level of anxiety that's starting to settle. Now we're in the drudgery. And I think what we're going to start to see or hear more about over the next coming weeks is going to be the frustration and the depression. Because if you got nowhere to go and nothing to do and no one to talk to, that's a really demoralizing, demotivating place to be, especially if there's this thought that even though the risk for me individually is low, I could go outside right now, meet the wrong person, and be dead in 2 weeks, right? That's kind of the calculus at that basic level. Even if the risk is low, right, the outcome is so bad that I can't discount it entirely. And so I think the things that we need to be watching for on the one hand are the anxiety. And I think the way to mitigate that is to recognize it and say, well, yeah, you know, I'm anxious, but I'm in this event that's kind of like, it's like World War II big. It's like Great Depression big. You know, those things we read about in history books in high school? Yeah, we're in one now. Like it or not, we're going to be a chapter in a history book one day that's going to be read by high schools in coming generations. And it's not surprising that that is an anxiety-provoking thing to be a part of. And it's going to be that way for some time, right? We're going to go through probably multiple pandemic waves before we have a vaccination. And that is going to, again, on the flip side, a lot of us are going to succumb, I think, to depression. A lot of us are going to kind of switch off, turn off. The risk is there. And again, I think the key is kindness to yourself, kindness to each other. Accept the fact that you're having bad days, right? Just let yourself have anxiety. There was this early, it's funny how March the 12th feels so long ago now, right? The day that the NBA canceled their season and suddenly everything started getting canceled and suddenly everybody was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? The virus is here. There was this movement early on. Well, you know, we have all this time, you know, we should all go home and be productive. But everyone's like, well, I just can't. I just can't get there, right? So, well, anxiety, it's just soaking up all your psychological energy. There's not enough left to be productive. Just get up in the morning. Just eat, right? Just survive. That's fine. It's good enough. There's nobody keeping score. Don't make yourself...
Yeah, don't hold up Newton as the one to aspire to.
Yeah, everybody.
In his played response.
Yeah, Newton. Like, oh yeah, he wrote the Principia during a lockdown for, what was it, Black Death? Or smallpox? One of those two, right? And it's like, you know, there's a reason we look to Newton, because there's only been one. You don't have to be the next Newton. Just let yourself have that anxiety. Expect to be less productive. Expect to have low moods. Expect there to be frustration. And just let yourself have it, right? And also be humbler if you can. Recognize when you've snapped and own up to that and say, oh, yeah, I kind of went a little over the top there. Because you're surrounded by people who are also under this very same stress and are going through very similar experiences, and the more kindness you can show to yourself and show to each other, the better we're going to be to weather it. The thing I wonder about in terms of clinical significance down the road is going to be to what degree this stays with people once we have the vaccine, once we're able to get back to kind of normal society. Are we looking at elevated rates of post-traumatic stress disorder? Are there going to be people who become permanently agoraphobic and are just terrified to go back outside again and re-engage with society?
Or claustrophobic, I suppose. Like,
sure.
You know, who wants to sit in a movie theater after this?
That's excellent too. So are we going to see a rise in phobias? Are we going to see individuals whose care about contamination edges over into obsessions about contamination and cleanliness and maybe evolves into full-on obsessive compulsive disorders? Or what's happening with individuals who are already struggling with psychiatric conditions, who are, unfortunately, it's just tougher to get to your treatment group or your support group or your psychiatrist under these circumstances, right? So there's a lot of people out there struggling who are going to keep on struggling even after we have a biological resolution to this problem. I think the psychiatric pandemic wave is going to be much slower and much longer than this one. And unfortunately, is going to be largely an invisible wave, although maybe not. You know, I'm open to being pleasantly surprised on that front. But that's what I'm wondering about, you know, as we get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years past this thing.
Yeah, I think September 11th was probably the last time there was a event that was this omnipresent. And
yeah,
the results of that lasted for a long time. So
sure,
this one's probably absolutely been hanging around for quite a while and linger.
Well, and the fact that this event is not going away, the fact that we have been... we've all been hijacked by the virus's agenda, and we are helpless in the face of that. It's going to go where it wants. It's going to do what it wants. It doesn't care about your politics. It doesn't care about your religion. It doesn't care about your wealth. It doesn't care who you voted for. It just wants bodies, and it's just going to keep blindly moving from body to body. And that's that fundamental loss of control. That's very difficult for us to tolerate as individuals and as a society.
Is there anything we didn't touch on that you'd like to discuss?
Oh, I know what we didn't talk about. Washing food.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sure. Yeah, let's briefly touch on that. There was a... Can we use viral videos anymore? Or is that... there was a video that went around social media quite a bit about a week ago about cleaning food. And I know you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah. Now, the... You know, again, I think it's pretty natural for people under situations like this to kind of really fall back on a precautionary principle kind of approach to things. Like, yeah, normally I just wash the vegetables with water, but they could have these coronavirus droplets on them. And so I'm going to just add a little bit of soap, or I'm just going to add a little bit of bleach. And in fact, there have been pretty good studies, mostly coming out of Singapore, attempting to find if there were any foodborne transmissions of the virus. And there's no evidence anywhere that there's been a foodborne transmission. And most food scientists, and you know, I'm not going to claim to be a food scientist because I'm not, right? I look to them for guidance and expertise. They're saying essentially, follow currently recommended best practices for safe handling. You know, wash the vegetables in water, wash your hands before you're preparing food, which is a best practice anyway. We should have been doing that this whole time. Tisk, tisk. And wash your hands after handling or discarding outer packaging on food before consuming or preparing food. And that's really it, right? This is one thing where we actually do get to relax. We don't have to take every, you know, we don't have to put the micro, the ice cream we bought at Safeway, we don't have to put that in the microwave.
Right, or leave groceries out in the garage for a week before consuming them.
We do not have to leave the salami on the front porch for 72 hours. And in fact, if you do wash your vegetables with soap, you could give yourself nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea. If you dip your broccoli in bleach and you don't rinse that properly, you can make yourself very, very sick, and you could end up in the ICU for reasons completely unrelated to coronavirus.
Yeah, at a time where it's really bad to be in the ICU.
Very, very bad time to be in the ICU. If I may use one colorful epithet, I posted the other day, you know, I noticed that when I'm out driving around, I'm driving way below the speed limit, because hospitals are very busy right now and they don't have time to deal with my bullshit. So, and what's interesting is on the daily briefing, numbers of visits to emergency rooms are down. Numbers of calls to ambulances are down. People are being, I think, especially careful in these times, which is a really good social response that we're all having. You know, we can get back to our reckless carelessness later, but for now, we need to be really careful. We need to be really thoughtful in all of our decisions. And so far, it seems like people are doing it. So I would just encourage you, you know, be thoughtful in relation to food as well. And if there are folks that are interested, I've posted on my Facebook feed, posters on safe food handling that are evidence-based, but it's really not much fancier than follow current best practices and wash your hands.
Well, Dr. Rob, before I let you go tonight, do you just tell our listeners where they can find you if they want more of your insight or follow your Twitter feed?
Oh, sure. So, yeah, so just I'm on Twitter. Just look for Rob Tarzwell. T-A-R-Z-W-E-L-L, viral transmissions, or on Facebook. That's probably where I'm most active. Just feel free to follow me. All my posts are public these days because they're all about the virus, the disease, public health readiness, tips, mitigation, the whole thing. I'm just trying to provide a source of rock solid, vetted information that counters the very widespread disinformation and misinformation.
Okay, excellent. Rob, thank you for joining me tonight.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Excellent. Greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, any opportunity to spread the word, not the virus.
Exactly. And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Bled Coast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.